This is Out of School, the podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Tonight, we've got three sponsors for the show, the first being EasyWatch.com, who has over 30 years of experience in the security camera systems industry. In addition to helping businesses, EasyWatch specializes in security cameras for schools. The show is also brought to you by Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect, and review student work, and to provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, grades, and more. And finally, the show is brought to you by TapTyping. The TapTyping app teaches students to type in the iPad. It has a structured curriculum with lessons ranging from beginner to advanced, a typing test for gauging improvement, and in addition to the built-in virtual keyboard and many third-party keyboards, has support for all types of external keyboards and keyboard cases. We'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. Bradley, how you doing?
Fantastic. I have a haircut, fresh haircut. I thought it was a good day. It's like a haircut day. And then I have a fresh cup of coffee that is not in a travel mug. So hopefully we will not go all Casey Liss on my Mac and spill it.
I got a new travel mug for my birthday recently. It's you heard of the Contigo mugs?
Yes, I used to have one.
Yeah, they're supposedly completely leak-proof. Mine has not leaked so far, so what can I say?
So my issue with travel mugs, because I love them, but I hate them. I hate coffee off of anything like silver or steel. Mm-hmm. I like the taste of coffee out of like a porcelain mug or a glass mug. But those obviously like let heat out crazily bad. And I'm okay with that. So like what I really need, because I drink my coffee fairly quickly, I don't need something that will like keep it warm for 2 hours. I need something that when I'm walking around the building, that doesn't spill. So I don't know what I need. Like, so if any listeners have an idea of what I need, I want something that's glass or porcelain, but also has like a spill-proof like lid on it.
They had like a ceramic mug that was it was styled like their paper cup, but it was ceramic and it had a rubber top. That may be the kind of thing you're looking for.
Yeah, I'll have to go by there and check. But because I don't even need it to be like spill-proof. I just need something where like when I'm walking and like just the natural vibrations of me walking, it doesn't like spill out, because then I have to go get paper towel and wipe it up, and it's a whole big thing.
Yeah, it's like slosh proof, isn't it?
Yeah, slosh proof. I need a slosh proof ceramic mug. Ceramic, yeah, I don't know why I said porcelain. It's the toilets. Ceramic mug. a slosh proof ceramic mug. So I'll have to go to Starbucks later. But but if you've never watched, if you listen to the Accidental Tech Podcast, not once, but twice, Casey Liss, who is a fantastic guy and is a over the years we've become friends, he spilled water all over his Mac laptop. Not once but twice. So first time it survived, and second time it took a trip to the depot.
Yeah, first time's an accident, second time is you should have maybe done something different. Yeah.
Well, you know, speaking of the depot, I don't do as much Mac repair as I used to. Mainly, we haven't needed it. This lease, we have all solid state drives, and what I was doing last lease was changing out hard drives when they died. So I literally have not taken apart the first MacBook Air since we've had it in our lease, and we get rid of these things in the spring. Mm-hmm. So actually, we own them now because we just paid off the lease. But it's so interesting to me how little repairs I'm doing. And then it seems like from when I do talk to people, like if you see people on Twitter talking about their Macs having issues, laptops are going straight to the depot now. Like they're not doing as much on site with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're basically like iPads now, aren't they?
Yeah. And you know that if you never replace a trackpad on a Mac laptop, that's like the worst thing to replace. But as they become like more and more integrated, there's just not as much to replace. And of course, watches are still being sent off to be repaired. I don't know. I imagine they're just like giving new watches and refurbishing the old one. But yeah, it's just like kind of interesting. Like the state of the Apple repair system is not bad, because they're certainly investing in it. If you have access to GSX on the back end, like they make continual updates to their tools, and a lot of their tools are moving cloud based, which is good. But you know, it seems like the actual things you would want to fix are like, you know, it's getting to where it's like, it's cheaper. It's actually cheaper sometimes to ship it off to the depot because it's a flat rate versus like paying an hourly rate to like your authorized service professional.
Yeah, because that could be, and I suppose as the more that happens, the less those people will have the skills to do whatever it is they need to do as well. Like you said, you've never opened one of those machines, so the time you would spend trying to figure it out for the first time would be quite substantial.
Yeah, that's the thing, and my schedule is is a lot different now than it used to be. And so I don't necessarily have the time to do like a lot of hardware repairs now because I'm teaching 5 classes most weeks, and there's just a lot of the things I'm responsible for now. It's a lot of kind of got back into operation stuff as much as it is just like fixing computers. And so it's like, you know, in some ways, if we have something that's going to take like a 4-hour repair, it's almost like less cost effective for me to do it more than just like send it off to the depot and have them do it, especially if we have a spare. And I'll tell you, great, if you're a school that doesn't have like a, you know, didn't overbuy on your laptops, a Chromebook makes a great kind of, in a pinch, somebody's computer's down for a couple of days, it makes a great in the pinch computer.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if a fast enough Chromebook could even sub for an iPad for certain pupils. You know, they could just log into iCloud.com and their documents would be there. And then if they were doing just that kind of task, they could grab a Chromebook and just, you know, in a pinch, just get something to type on there.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. I suppose, you know, we are starting to use more Google Docs in the school, you know, with the students. You know, previously we've really spent a lot of time focusing on iWork primarily. That's been our main office tool for years. But what I'm finding is that the students who know about Google Docs are using it when they find it appropriate. So they're actually very sophisticated at choosing when to use which one. So they'll often use Google Docs when they they're doing a task within part of the group or the whole group. But when they're doing something on their own, they'll just do it in Pages. And they're actually very relaxed at moving between multiple different tools, which I think is a great learning experience, but also it shows us a certain maturity in their choice of tools as well, which is really nice to see.
Yeah, because like long gone are the days where like, I mean, when I first got into the workplace, your tools were, you came into the office and you opened up Office. You opened up like Word, Excel, and Outlook. And that's like how you did your job. Those, like, especially in education, like for students, those days are just gone. It's a multitude of tools from a multitude of companies. And there's just like, it's a lot more complicated, but it's just kind of the way the world has gone.
I completely refute the idea that it's a lot more complicated, because if you've ever tried to use Microsoft Office, it's the worst of them all. So that was way harder. Even still is way harder. They've ported that onto their Macs, their iPad stuff as well. So,
well, I mean
that's like a rant for last week. I don't want to go down that line again.
I'm more meaning from like a sysadmin perspective. Like, it's so easy.
Yeah.
You know, you just like, okay, everything is in Office. Your files are on the shared drive. Open up Office and do your work.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was having this discussion. I had a visit from some people from a local school, or not that local, a school, one in Glasgow, today, and they were talking about, you know, where's your shared drive and where are your servers and things like that. And I was saying, well, you know, the iPad is the pupil's primary storage, and then we have Google Drive as a sort of nearline cloud storage, and then we've got iCloud backup for, you know, disaster recovery. And you get those three layers of storage, and the robustness of the device is, you know, it's quite dependable. We've not had very many complete failures of the device over 5 years. So it's an interesting, all of these things are starting to change a little bit, and I think that Google Docs is becoming, you know, increasingly usable and increasingly powerful in iOS as well. You know, gone are the days when you used to have a different view to look at the file versus edit it, and a much simplified editing view. The Docs tools have really come on in iOS. And to that point, there were new features.
Yeah, that was all the tools. I guess it's funny, like it seems like all of Google's apps for iOS get updated all like the same day, because Google Photos got an update, the Google iOS admin app, like if you can manage your Google Apps domain, got an update, which is broken for me. It's something with two-factor authentication. I cannot get in. But and then, yeah, the Google Drive and all the tools got updated. Of course, I tell you, the more I live in this world where all the tools are broken out separately, the more I hate it, like that there's a separate Docs app. I it's confusing and I hate it.
Yeah, I think the thing that confuses me more is the idea that when you launch the Docs app, you get a completely different interface to what you get when you launch the Drive app. But I've noticed that at least in the current update, if not in several previous ones, if you open a doc from Google Drive, it remembers that it came from Drive. And when you close the doc, it goes back to Drive now, which is nice, because previously it used to go back to the Docs picker, which was confusing because suddenly you're in this blue world, which has only got your docs in it, whereas you came from the world where all your files were there. So they're starting to refine that a little bit. And I can see how... I can't deny, Bradley, that what has happened since they did break out all those apps from Google Drive is that the pace of improvement on those apps has gone up massively. When it was a monolithic app, it was very slow to get better, and now it's way, way much better than it ever was. So I guess on balance, I'll take that.
Well, it, you almost in a way wish that it's, I don't know, like I was going to say, maybe they do something like Microsoft did with their, I know they have OneDrive. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like make it where if you have a spreadsheet, you would go to the spreadsheets app first, but that's like going back to the, like the iCloud model, or going to the iCloud model where it's like it's all about the app and not about where your documents are. I don't, you know, I don't know. It's a conundrum on software development.
Yeah, I mean, I tidy my Google Drive quite carefully, you know, and I keep things in different folders, but I increasingly find myself just searching for the file that I want. And that seems to be my kind of first port of call, particularly if I go into those apps where it's just a reverse chronological list of the documents I have in my entire drive. Searching for it, unless it's something you've used recently, is probably the way to go.
So before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's EasyWatch.com. They have over 30 years experience in the security camera systems industry. In addition to helping businesses, they also specialize in security camera systems for schools. Many school camera systems are not sufficient, and EasyWatch values the quality of their products and their customers above all else, meaning they won't sell it if it doesn't meet their standards. EasyWatch tests every system extensively and offers lifetime technical support. During the past 15 years, over 100,000 EasyWatch systems have been installed, and over 60% of their sales come from repeat customers, which they believe is the greatest endorsement of the quality of their products and the excellent customer service you'll receive at EasyWatch.com. They have a great deal for listeners of this podcast. If you go to easywatch.com/out of school and get a custom quote, you'll get 17% off. easywatch.com/out of school. It's E-Z, the letter E, letter Z, watch.com/out of school. Thanks to easywatch.com for sponsoring the show this week.
Okay, so what's up tonight? Where are we at?
The show is ending. This is it. Mic drop then, right? Nah. You know, it's funny. We celebrated our 30th anniversary, and I kind of forgot about that.
So did I. It's so close to the start of the term that we are always going to like blow past it.
Well, I guess in reality, to me, episode 150 is a more of a thing to me than like we've had the show on online for 3 years, because there's plenty of things you can just like do five episodes of a year and say we've had a podcast for 3 years. But yeah, so we have 150 here in a few weeks, though.
Yeah, do you remember when we started this, Bradley? I said, I'm not sure what we're going to talk about after the first 10 episodes.
Well, I think our plan was to do 20 and take some time off. Yeah. And
That never happened.
Always something. But this is getting into like I love like the fall, because there's still all the excitement of like school starting. We have all the new Apple stuff, and none of us are exhausted yet. By like April, I am spent.
Yeah. So the week before Christmas is another low point in the school year, I think. It's just sort of dragging yourself to the end of term.
Concerts and what's funny around here is like after school's out on the last day, everybody like gets all their Christmas stuff out of the room. Like it's like Christmas is over at school and it hasn't even happened yet. But no one wants to come back. No one wants to come back and deal with it in January.
Yeah, you're always pulling down the Christmas tree and like 2 days before the end of term. You're like, sorry, kids, Christmas is actually cancelled this year. We primary ones are crying and it's all a disaster. Parents are phoning up complaining. You
know. Yes. Dear. So new series we're starting this week. We talked last week about the Diffusion of Innovations book. So hopefully if you are listening and you've read chapter 5.
Okay, yeah, we're going to dive in right into chapter 5. Last week, we kind of gave an overview of the sort of structure of the book and where I tried to pull out where I thought the most important chapters were versus the other chapters that were more background knowledge or, you know, data or incidental knowledge or whatever. So we're going to jump right to chapter 5. And today, Bradley, we're going to look at this. Chapter 5 is called the Innovation Decision Process. And it talks about the innovation decision process as being the process through which an individual passes when from gaining initial knowledge of an innovation to forming an attitude towards the innovation to making a decision to adopt or reject the idea. But before we kind of get into that, I want to just clarify again, because it's important, that an innovation is not the same thing as an invention. An invention is some kind of completely new discovery or new creation that did not exist before or wasn't known about before, whereas an innovation is something that is new to the person who's considering adopting it. And that's important because it doesn't have to be a brand new thing. It could be something that's been around for years and years, but you're just hearing about it. And now you begin the innovation decision process through which you're going to go in order to come to a point where you decide, yes, I am going to adopt this innovation, or no, I'm going to reject it. So that's important to bear in mind as we go through this.
Yeah, and if you haven't started along and you want to stop here, there'll be a link in the show notes where you can go download the Kindle version of the book.
Yep. But we'll push on just now. So the innovation decision process, Bradley, the key thing to understand about this is that it's a process that happens over time. It's not an instantaneous event. Very few people hear about something and make an instant decision about, well, that sounds ridiculous, I'm not going to do it, or I'm definitely going to do that right away. Now, some things you hear about that and you know that that's exactly what you want to do. But very often people go through a process of, well, finding out some information and so on. And in the book, Everett Rogers talks about five specific stages of innovation decision. And they are knowledge, persuasion, decision, implementation, and confirmation. And we're going to go through all five of those tonight, with talk about some examples and some things that you and I have seen, Bradley, in our visits to other schools and in our life in our own school, when it comes to trying to persuade people to adopt new technologies or new ideas in the school. And again, this applies equally to a new maths curriculum or a new set of reading books as it does to digital technology in the classroom. But obviously, you know, that's where our focus is, you and I, and probably most of the listeners as well. But it's useful to bear these terms in mind when it comes to other things you might want to bring into your school as well.
You know, we wouldn't be real educators if we didn't come up with like a way to remember that, the knowledge, persuasion, decision, implementation, confirmation. So, you know, like the planets, my very intelligent mother just served us 9 pizzas, but I guess Pluto's not a planet anymore. But so I came up with kind people don't ignore coffee.
I'm going to go with that.
Kind people don't ignore coffee. So, yeah, there is your five stages of the innovation decision process. Kind people don't ignore coffee. Persuasion or knowledge, persuasion, decision, implementation, confirmation.
Okay, so let's dig into this a little bit and talk about what each of these things are. The first being knowledge, okay? And what happens with knowledge, Bradley, is that when an individual is exposed to knowledge about the innovation's existence, and then over time, they gain more of an understanding about how it functions. And one of the kind of questions that's raised in the book is whether, is it the knowledge of an innovation that comes first, or your awareness of a need for something to solve a problem that then forces you to go and find out about an innovation? And the author kind of goes round about the houses a little bit to sort of say it's a bit of both. You know, it could be sometimes the existence of an innovation creates in you a desire or a need to have that. And other times you know you need, a slosh-proof coffee cup, and then you want to go out and find one. And then you know the need, and then you go and find out the innovation. And it's a bit of both, and different at different times for different people in different scenarios, I think it's probably fair to say.
Well, because there will be problems that you will exist that you are not aware that you have. Going back to my ceramic mug, let's say I didn't have one, hadn't thought about it, and then I know I'm going through my day and coffee spills here and there, especially in the mornings. And then I go to Starbucks one day and see that, and I think, oh my gosh, that would solve that problem for me. And so it's it can be both. And I think depending on the situation, sometimes one will come before the other.
And the conversation I was having today, people often ask me when they come to the school, they say, well, how did your staff react to, you know, did they buy into the idea of iPads straight away? Because they're basically asking, how can I get my staff on board? You know, is what they really mean by that question. And I often say to people, look, one of the reasons we did the iPad program to start with was because teachers were telling me they couldn't get enough time on the computer. So many of our staff, if not all of our staff, were aware of their need for more access to computers. And then the iPad as an innovation came along to solve that need. And therefore, we got a very good adoption very quickly because people were aware of their need and they were presented with a solution, and then they adopted it in large part. So that's how that knowledge came about for us, just as one example. So the author talks about three types of knowledge, and I think this was very enlightening to me, this idea of three different types of knowledge about an innovation. And I'll tell you what they are, and then I'll give you an example of where I think a lot of schools kind of stop in their iPad journey, if you like. And the first kind of knowledge is what's called awareness knowledge. And that's basically, I know that the thing exists. So you could say, well, I know about the iPad. I know that lots of schools are using it. I know it can be useful for word processing and presentations and video editing and photography and so on. That's awareness knowledge. You know that it exists. The next level up is how-to knowledge, it's called, and it's about knowing enough to use it properly. So a teacher might be able to say, well, I know how I might use an iPad in the classroom. I'm going to use it for internet research and writing papers and presentations and making posters and data analysis and whatever. You know, so there's how-to. I can actually get the innovation. I can put it into use in a competent way. But, and this is where I thought it got fascinating with the conversation about iPad, is that there's another level of knowledge above that, which is called principles knowledge. And that's where you know the underlying principles that make this innovation work. And that's like, I understand how iOS works, and I know how to deploy it correctly in my school. And I think I would argue, Bradley, that most schools and teachers are kind of somewhere between awareness knowledge and how-to knowledge. And many people who are considered like expert iPad teachers, what they have is they have a high level of how-to knowledge. They know how to apply the iPad to the pedagogical problem that they have in their school and the curriculum they want to deliver. But what I fear most in the whole kind of scheme of iPad deployments is that not many schools are dealing at the principal's knowledge level with iOS. And they know how to use it in the classroom, but they don't really quite know how to understand it and how to deploy it properly. Many of them are trying to deploy it like it was a Windows computer, and that's where I think a lot of deployments eventually become unstuck, because their level of sophistication is not that high when it comes to the principles, the underlying principles of how that particular innovation works.
Do you think, in some ways, and I know, do you think like some IT people are at a disadvantage when it comes to the iPad? Because for so long, with the Windows world, it's fine. It's like embedded to like control, 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 control. And then it says, all right, guys, we're doing the iPad. Do the iPad. Figure it out. And they have to like learn to give up all that control. Where if you've got like a teacher that's kind of tasked with the program that just falls into it, they don't know that world. And so they don't have those tendencies to give up. So do you think, my question is, do you think like teachers with no deployment experience are in some ways at an advantage over a veteran IT sysadmin?
I think the key thing that makes a great systems administrator in times of change like this is their ability to unlearn as much as it is their ability to learn. And I think you're right that there's a tendency for control. There always has been for Windows deployments. And the reason for that is because Windows is so lacking in robustness that it needs to be defended at every turn from the user, right? The user can destroy this computer so easily that we have to lock and lock and lock and lock. So all you can do is go in and double click Word. And I think the general robustness of modern platforms, whether that be Chrome OS or iOS, really takes away the necessity for that particular level of control, and the requirement for control moves higher. But I think in both cases, I think there's a lack of knowledge there, because each side doesn't know what the other side has to worry about, right? So the sysadmin is worrying about things like backup and disaster recovery and data protection and all these things, and network management and not overloading the network and so on. And the teacher just wants to make sure the lesson works correctly. And the traditional split between IT people and teachers is such a problematic thing, because each side cares about their thing and they don't care about the other side's thing, really. I'm maybe being a little harsh on IT people there, but I certainly, you know, based on the actual measurable outcomes of what they do, one would have to say that it's probably true that many of them are much more concerned about defending themselves from security and data loss problems than they are about enabling users in that sense.
And
of course,
the
problem...
I get that world. Like, I get defending yourself, because if you grew up or if you were, like, working in IT from, like, 02 to 010 or something, I'm just picking out an arbitrary year, your whole life was defending against like XP spyware. That was your life.
Yeah. And there's a kind of a trench warfare mentality burned into a lot of those people, and just because of their experiences. And I think, you know, many people can't believe that here's a platform where that kind of thing just genuinely doesn't happen. You know, genuinely doesn't happen. And I suppose it's hard for people to let go of that kind of thing. But it's when it comes to principles knowledge, I mean, one of the things that I think is difficult is that the principles of deployment that you used for both for Mac and Windows don't necessarily apply to iOS, because there's a key difference, and it happened on OS X with Lion, I think it was, where when Lion, I think, was the first Mac OS that supported configuration profiles in the same way that iOS did. And clearly what Apple was doing there was they were moving their platform away from a shared device that you can image to an individually used device that you can layer configuration policy on top. And iOS has always been like that, really. You can do sort of backup and restore imaging on iOS, but on OS X you could always do that. And now I think a lot of people are realizing that Macs are, while you can still have multi-user systems, the majority of Macs in an organization are probably used by one person primarily, and configuration profiles are a thing that lies on top. And I think that's moving over to that world of laying policy on top of something that the users get to play with a lot is quite a hard shift for a lot of people who are used to Windows XP and Vista to deal with.
Yeah, it's a lot has happened in the last 15 years of sysadmin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has. And I think just the sheer number of computers that has gone up and up and up, and the fact that computers are not, they're not a part of the furniture anymore, they're a part of the person. If that makes sense. You know, I think when my father used to go to work, there were PCs on desks, and it almost didn't matter which desk you sat down at. You could work on any of the PCs. Whereas today it's much more like, here, you're a new employee, here's your MacBook, here's your phone. They're yours. Nobody else is ever going to use them. So set it up however you want, and we're going to put our VPN credentials on top and our policy on top. And then if both of us can agree that we get our desired levels of control, then we're going to be fine. You know, and I think that's kind of that's the modern attitude in IT. But it's crucial that you have platforms that are robust enough to actually allow that to happen without damage. iOS is absolutely that kind of platform. Mm-hmm. As is Chrome OS, I guess. Yeah,
I was at a conference or a class, like, gosh, back in like 07, 08, and there's somebody from Google there, and she's like, yeah, we don't have, like, I met other people at Google that have offices, but she's like, we don't have desk phones. She's like, we have cell phones and laptops, and they tell us just to work wherever. Like, there's like place, it's basically you can go work anywhere. Like, there's, it wasn't cubicles, but she's like, there's a desk all over the building, and we just work wherever mm-hmm. we want to that day, and you have your phone, you have your cell phone, and you have your, you know, laptop, and that's all your stuff.
Yep, and you're living in your email and your chat and messaging and so on. So that's the way that's going. But let me push on, Bradley, because if we don't, we'll never get through this whole thing because it's quite long.
Well, let me thank our second sponsor for the night real quick.
Yeah, let's do that.
Fine folks at Shobi. It's an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, teachers can easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads and then provide feedback directly on the documents through rich annotations and with features such as the pen tool and text and voice notes. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of iPad apps or by using Shobi's built-in tools. New to Shobi for this school year is the Gradebook feature for Shobi Pro, which allows teachers to easily add, review, and export student grades. More great features like student portfolios and parent access will be coming to Shobi later this fall. Shobi Basic is free, and individual teachers listening to this podcast will get a gradebook and the enhanced annotation features of Shobi Pro for 30% off if they purchase annually. So go to shobi.com/out of school for that discount. Start your paperless classroom today by downloading Shobi in the App Store or by visiting shobi.com.
Okay, let me say one more thing about knowledge, Bradley, which is there's a question about who learns about innovations when, okay? And some people know about innovations way ahead of other people, right? But there are characteristics that apply to these people, and the author lists a kind of set of attributes that people who know about innovations early have versus those who know later. And the first is that they're typically better educated. They have higher social status. They have more exposure to mass media. They maintain more interpersonal channels of communication. They have more contact with change agents, which are people working for organizations who want to persuade people to adopt innovations. They have more social participation and they're more cosmopolitan than people who know later on, right? So there's the one thing about knowledge is, when do you know about an innovation? So do you know about the Tesla Model X car that just got, you know, the price just got announced this week? If you're well connected online or with other people in the tech circles, you'll know about that soon. Other people might know about that a year from now. So the other thing to bear in mind, though, is that no matter when you find out about it, it doesn't necessarily affect how quickly you actually adopt. Because one of the things that distinguishes early adopters from later adopters is the length of their innovation decision process. How long do they take to come to a decision about adoption or rejection of an innovation? So worth bearing that in mind.
True.
Okay, so that's knowledge, Bradley. And the next stage is what we call persuasion. And persuasion, by definition, is what occurs when an individual forms a favorable or unfavorable attitude towards an innovation. Okay, so this is where you're starting to make your mind up about the innovation. You know about it. You've maybe gained some how-to knowledge, maybe even some principles knowledge. And now you're starting to decide, do I think that's something that I could use or not? Okay. And the key thing, the key distinguishing thing about persuasion versus knowledge is that knowledge is a cognitive process. It's about learning and gaining knowledge, whereas persuasion is what you might call an affective process. It's much more about how you feel about the thing rather than knowing what it is. So a good example here is Google Glass, right? Where you know, you can quite easily comprehend the technical side of Google Glass, which is there's a prism and a little projector, and you can, once you get a grip of what that is, the rest of it's kind of obvious. But how you feel about Google Glass is something that maybe takes a lot more time to develop. You're like, okay, I know what that is, but I'm not sure how I feel about Google Glass. Let's wait and see on that one. And different innovations will have different characteristics that will make people feel that way or maybe just want to adopt it straight away. But during the persuasion phase, the individual will actively seek out knowledge about the innovation. So they might have, they might want to, you know, reviews, or this is where reviews come in. This is where, you know, YouTube unboxing comes in, demos and things like that, going to the Apple store, all that kind of thing. So seeking out more information. And the key skill in this is hypothetical reasoning and counterfactual reasoning that some people, perhaps people who have lower levels of education, might find more difficult to do. And what I mean by that is that's like, if I adopted this innovation, what would it do for me? Right? If I buy Google Glass, what could I do with it? You know, I could, you know, skydive and take a video or whatever. But do I actually skydive? No, I don't skydive. So why would I bother getting Google Glass? So it's about that kind of, that form of reasoning, which some people find easy and some people find incredibly difficult. And I suppose in the sort of iPad arena, one of the ways in which you see people struggling with that is some teachers, when presented with something like iPad, will immediately think up 20 ways to use that in their classroom. And other teachers will demand a field visit to 5 different schools in order to see how it works in practice, because they can't possibly imagine anything themselves. They can't think forward, project themselves into the future and see themselves as somebody who uses iPad. And I'm not necessarily, Bradley, I'm not criticizing people for needing that, but I'm just saying that there are people who need that and there are people who clearly don't need that. And that's a big difference in the way that people adopt, because how much persuasion they need from other people.
Yeah, none of it's good and bad. It's just, we all, in some ways, learn differently. So those ideas will come to you and you'll see the applications differently and at different times. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I remember going to a school once where the sysadmin there, it was asking me, what did I think about Microsoft Surface? And what did I think about, this is back in the days when Surface RT was still a thing. And he's like, why don't we get a Surface RT tablet instead? And I was like, yeah, well, Surface RT, it's got none of this. And I listed off like 5 or 6 of the things that I thought were problematic about Surface RT. And he said to me, have you got one? And I said, no, I don't have one. But, you know, I've learned enough to know that I can see how those things could be big problems. And he said, well, how can you possibly know that if you haven't tried it yourself? I said, well, because I thought about it, you know, and it was a kind of strange moment for me, because this guy was one of those people who, I guess, perhaps found that kind of hypothetical reasoning a little more difficult. And he was the kind of guy who wanted one on his desk to try it before he could form an opinion about it either way. Whereas, you know, I was reading about it and I thought, well, you know, if the Surface RT doesn't run any of these desktop Microsoft apps, then what's the point in, you know, getting that device, because it only runs a small fraction of the software. And that was one of the criticisms of the iPad at the time. So, you know, how is that better than the iPad? If it doesn't, the Surface RT doesn't run the software as well. You know, it was arguments like that I was making, and he was kind of like, but you haven't tried it. You don't know. And I'm like, well, yeah, I sort of do, because I've read other kinds of information about it as well. So another thing to talk about with persuasion is who's involved in persuasion. So when it comes to knowledge, when gaining knowledge, mass media is your friend. That's where you look at adverts, you see billboards, you maybe go to, you know, Apple stores are sort of a form of mass media, if you like, learning that way. But when people want to be persuaded one way or the other, they actually seek out friends and trusted mentors and colleagues rather than mass media. So you might learn about something through an advert. You might even learn how it works by looking at the Apple website, but then I want to go and ask somebody, you know, what do you think of this new iPad Air 2? Or what do you think about this iPhone 6 Plus? You know, and I think, you carry an iPhone 6 Plus now, Bradley?
Yes.
Yeah. So you'll have had this experience as well, that a lot of people want to see your iPhone 6 Plus. They want to ask you about it, which is not something that I think iPhone 6 users are getting quite so much, but 6 Plus users, because it's this really strange thing that most people don't have knowledge about, or they don't have anything they can relate to it with their experience. They want to ask you how you're getting on with it. Is it genuinely easy to use? Is it genuinely manageable in the hand and so on? And I think that's a very interesting phase that people go through, is, you know, mass media first, and then they want to know from trusted colleagues and friends, what do you think about this innovation? And that's how they start to build their own feelings towards it.
Yeah, like you're just I went through that with when I was thinking about the 6 Plus, was just talking to people. Like, what do you think about it? How does it impact your iPad uses? How does it impact what you can do on your phone? What can you do on the phone differently because of this?
Yeah. And there are possible failures in this persuasion problem as well. And there's a thing that's known as the CAP gap. CAP is K-A-P, standing for knowledge, attitudes, and practice. And this is when you end up having a favorable attitude towards something, but still not doing it. And the classic example is all kinds of preventative measures, such as stopping smoking or losing weight or taking more exercise or something. You know, I might have I could imagine myself being like 4 stone lighter. And I would really like that. I would have a very favorable attitude towards that final scenario, but I'm not doing a whole lot about it. You know, so it's a funny situation that some people can get into psychologically, where they like the idea of this and they're favorable towards it, but it's something they don't adopt. You know, so the iPad seems great, but it'll never work in this school, or it's just not for me. But the iPad's fine, but it's not for me, is often a defense that a lot of teachers come out with as well. So have I persuaded you about persuasion?
I am very persuaded.
Mm-hmm. Trusted confidant I am. So that's persuasion. And it's mostly about when people begin to form their attitude towards the innovation either way. And it can be negative as well as positive. I mean, the Google Glass example, I think a lot of people form the very negative attitude towards it. Decision is kind of obvious, right? So we've got knowledge, persuasion, decision. And decision is basically when you start to make a choice either way. But there's two things that are quite important here. One is the possibility of trialing. So we mentioned just a wee bit last week about the properties of innovations that make them more likely to be adopted, and one of them is trialability. And when you make that decision, a decision that's often made is contingent on a successful trial of some kind. So we've made the decision to try, and then we'll make another decision later whether or not to actually fully adopt. And trialability is important, but I would really strongly argue, Bradley, that it's very important to get clarity about what exactly it is you're going to trial. And I think that requires clarity beforehand in being clear about what innovation is you're actually adopting. And I think if people look at our school, they often look at us as being quite an innovative school, but they misattribute what the innovation actually is. Right, they think the innovation is using the iPad in the classroom, but the actual innovation is going one-to-one. That's the thing that has really been the transformational aspect of it. The iPad's great, don't get me wrong, it was the right choice then, I still think it's the right choice now, but the actual innovation is going one-to-one. And many schools who talk about going one-to-one, they're not clear about which part of the iPad or the one-to-one is the big innovation for their school. And of course, some schools who are one-to-one before and switch to the iPad, it's a very technical innovation, whereas most schools, of course, are not one-to-one, and it's going one-to-one is the big change for their school. And I think it's really key to, when you're doing trialing of these kind of things, it's key to trial the right thing. You know, not to trial the iPad when you actually need to trial the one-to-one concept. So you've probably seen, as I have, Bradley, schools where they buy 30 iPads and they put two in every classroom, and this is their one-to-one trial. That's not a one-to-one trial. That's an iPad trial. It tells you nothing about being one-to-one. So you've got a problem there with the design of your trial if it's not giving you the information you need in order to make the right decision about what the actual innovation is.
Yeah, you'd be better off to buy 30 and put them in two classrooms of 15 and give two classrooms one-to-one.
Yep. And that tells you that's a lot more learning than just having some iPads. You know, and I've kind of derided this in the past as sprinkling the magic iPad fairy dust over your school and hoping for the best, because quite often, you know, I was talking to one friend, she teaches in another school, and she said, "Oh yeah, I had the school iPad home for the weekend." It's like, "What, singular?" And she's like, Yeah, we've only got the one." You know, it's like, "Well, you know, what's that for?" You know? She's like, "So we can try iPads, you know." So that's trialing is fine, but I think there's a lot of mistakes made in trialing because the actual design of the test isn't correct, because it doesn't test the condition you are going to end up in some smaller scale. And trialability is important for innovations. And in schools, the way you trial it is you trial it for a period of time with everybody, or you trial it with a subset of the school. But a thick subset, like you said, Bradley, one or two classes fully enabled, rather than a thin slice across the school where everybody gets a wee bit of the iPad. It was very, very tricky just to get that right, but I think it's important. In fact, I know it's important.
Well, it's just funny that this book was written. When was this last updated? Was it 95?
Well, the author's dead now, so the fifth edition is, I think, the last one, and it's not that recent.
It's like some of these ideas stay tried and true.
Yeah, and I think that's what's very interesting about the book to me, Bradley, is you can apply it to the latest thing we're doing in schools, as well as to, you know, the early studies were involving things like hybrid corn seed in Iowa and things like that. And in both cases, you can apply those lessons, and it's a very, very perceptive book overall. And I mentioned one other thing about decision, of course, that when you come to decisions, you also have the possibility of rejection, right? You could decide not to. And there's a couple of ways in which people reject. You've got active rejection, where you've thought about it and you've done it or decided not to do it. And then there's passive rejection, where you've never really considered it, or you trial something and just let it go or whatever. And I don't see a lot of schools who trial iPad programs taking an active rejection approach. You know, there's not that many schools who trial iPads and then don't go ahead and do something. But what there is massive everywhere is just passive rejection. There's the vast majority of schools who just never consider doing it in the first place. And, you know, there are local authorities in Scotland where they just have straightforward and blanket bans that say, we do not use any Apple products in this entire local authority. Therefore, don't even bother thinking about trying the iPad, because we won't let you get any. And that is a genuine policy position that exists today in Scotland in some local authorities. And for those schools, they're very much being funneled down this channel of passive rejection of iPads, or indeed Google Chromebooks, I guess, because they're just not being allowed to even consider adopting that kind of technology. It's hard to believe that kind of thing still goes on, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but it's... There are
but
a lot
it's
of,
not at the same time.
Yeah, it's not. There's just a lot of opportunity, and there's a lot of people out there. So, yeah, it's like we kind of live in the world where, you know, we think what we think, and we often just, like, associate with people that think the way we think and think the way we want to progress our classrooms and progress technology in the schools. And so when you hear of things that are, like, different, it's like, oh, people still think that way? But, yeah.
Yeah, that's still a thing, yeah. You want to do another sponsor, and then we'll go into implementation.
Yeah, yeah. Last sponsor of the night is the fine folks at Tap Typing. The Tap Typing app teaches students to type on the iPad. It has a structured curriculum with lessons ranging from beginner to advanced, a typing test for gauging improvement, in addition to the built-in virtual keyboard and many third-party keyboards, has support for all types of external keyboards and keyboard cases. Tap Typing has many educator-focused features. Tap Typing has many educator-focused features as well. It is appropriate for all ages and it supports multiple user profiles in a single install of the app. Additionally, Tap Typing sends no personal data to the cloud, so there are no student privacy issues with the app. After just 3 sessions in Tap Typing, beginners increase their typing speeds by over 60% on average. This minimal time investment yields a permanent boost to productivity and soothes one of the most painful aspects of the iPad user experience, typing. This is a great app. I've mentioned before, I own like 80 licenses of it. It's a fantastic app. It is the way to learn how to type better on the iPad. So learn more about it. Go to gettaptyping.com. Again, that's gettaptyping.com. And we'll have a link in the show notes at outofschool.net. And this is episode 148.
Okay, so we've got implementation after that, Bradley, and then confirmation. And implementation is as its name suggests, that's when people take action to put the idea into use, okay? And distinguishing feature of this phase is that this is the first phase where you actually have to do something. In all the other phases, you can think about it and talk about it, but this is where your overt behavior is going to change rather than just doing a mental exercise. And what's key about implementation is that when it comes to implementation, you don't have to be fully formed and ready to do it. You've just observed that there is enough in this innovation that you want to go ahead and do it. But you still require information at this point. But the information is much more on the nature of how do I implement this, or how, rather than what can this do or how does it work for me. But you need to know things like, where do I get it? How many do I buy? Do I lease it or do I buy it? You know, questions like that. How do you manage it? Where do you plug it in? And all these kind of things. And people still need that kind of information. And I think, Bradley, tell me what you think as well, that schools often come unstuck on this area because they assume that once they've decided the educational case for it, they know everything they need to know and they just want to go ahead and get the devices at that point. You've probably seen something like that. I've certainly seen it several times.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's like you have this excitement. It's like, well, let's just do it. You know, it's like the Nike attitude. It's like, let's just do it. And we're going to throw these iPads at the wall and we'll make it work.
Yeah. And quite often that's where schools neglect to keep sort of seeking the technical information that they need to complete the adoption properly. And part of the reason for that, quite honestly, Bradley, is that the people who are selling the equipment are poorly incentivized to continue to provide that knowledge after the fact. Quite often resellers will come in and do that job for you and then leave. And the school has developed no capacity to manage that deployment or run it or innovate it in any way themselves. And, the biggest example in the world of that going wrong was in the Los Angeles iPad project, where they hadn't completely understood the level of security that you could provide with an MDM enrollment at that point. And as far as we can tell from the outside, the technical problem in LA was that the kids were just taking off the MDM enrollment profile from their device and losing all the restrictions. And it seems like somebody there hadn't taken the time to understand the technical knowledge he needed to successfully implement, even though they had figured out the educational plan. Now, we can debate their educational plan as well, I suppose, but I don't want to do that tonight. I just want to observe that that's an example of failing to get a grip of all the technical information you need to make sure that the way that you implement your innovation actually meets the goals that you have identified earlier on in the program. And that's where the challenge lies for many schools, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
So you've got to keep learning even after you've made the decision is key. But I want to mention one other thing, which is when we talk about implementation, there's this thing called reinvention that happens. And reinvention is where the people who are adopting an innovation change it as they go. And that can be done for lots of different reasons. And firstly, it can just be done for ignorance. The people don't know enough about the technology to adopt it correctly. So they adopt it wrongly, and then it sort of changes as they adopt it. Other times, the innovations are just too complex. So people have to change them and simplify them in order to make them adoptable. And that's often true of a lot of government initiatives where a big, beautifully worked out scheme comes out and then you just realize that in practice this cannot be done. You know, it just simply doesn't work. One example of that in Scotland was with the new exam system that came out. They had a process of verification where schools would send the exam board their marking decisions and the evidence, and then other people would check your decision making and then send it back to you. And in the first year, they decided they were going to do 3 rounds of this across the year. And it just became obvious very, very quickly that there wasn't enough time in the school year because they decided that the first verification round was going to be, I think, in November. And what you had to have done was you had to have taught some stuff from August, done an assessment on it, marked the assessment, had your assessment checked internally, and then have it ready to send off and do all of that in the first 2 months of the school year. So that was never going to work. So that was an innovation that had to get simplified. It had to get reinvented as we adopted it in schools as well.
Yeah, things like that always take longer. It's always like people assume things are going to go much faster than they do.
Yeah. There just wasn't the time to get it through the process before the next one came out. Three other things why reinvention can happen. One is if the invention is highly general, like a computer, for example. Many people who use computers use them in lots of different ways, and we see the same thing with mobile phones as well, where the way that you adopt this innovation and the way I adopt it, there's not one way to use a smartphone. You know, some people might be really into scheduling an email. Other people might just use it to play games on. Right? So there are many different ways to adopt a highly general innovation. And then there's reasons of local pride. So not invented here can be worked around by reinventing it here. You know, putting our logo on it, or in Scotland we put the word Scottish in front of it to make it Scottish. You know, so the Scottish this, as opposed to just the this that everybody else does. Adaptation to an organizational structure is another one. So there's a system, it works for some schools, it doesn't work for others. We have to change it a little bit because here we do it this way. Therefore, we have to have this innovation done differently. And the final reason for reinvention is that when later adopters come to adopt, the early adopters have learned something that mean that the later adopters will adopt it in a different way. So maybe there's a new way to do something or a new technique that you would do that early adopters didn't know, the later adopters do know, and they adopt it differently as well. So a couple of examples on that, Bradley. One is that iPad deployments can be reinvented in the classroom quite well. You know, because of its flexibility, teachers can often be very creative in how they adopt iPad in schools. Whereas when systems administrators try and reinvent iPad deployment techniques, they basically always end up in failure. And this is because iOS deployment is a very sort of scripted process in the sense that if you do what Apple recommends, it will work. But if you think you've found a way around that whole thing and you're going to do it this way, it's amazing how often that always ends in disaster. So reinvention by teachers, good. Reinvention of deployment techniques by sysadmins, not good. And that's kind of where I think an interesting distinction lies in iOS at the moment. Still with me?
Yes.
Okay, good. So much in this book. It's really rich. It's incredibly rich.
Well, it's one of the, it like kind of just builds, you know, you can just take so many scenarios in your life and technologies you've looked at and purchases you've made. And like, you can just, it's like when I learned about the archetypal hero quest and every hero goes on, you then kind of can't read a book without thinking through that Watch a movie without thinking through that. And so like when you're reading this book and you're thinking, oh, that's why I have that purchase, or that's why I ended up selling that. You know, so as we get on the confirmation, we're going to talk about, rejecting an innovation after previously adopting it. Like, that's a real thing, and like it happens all the time. But there's like, you know, it's like a academia type study that as a process, it happens with certain innovations. Like they are new and exciting, and then you realize it's you know, it's not the right thing for you.
Yep. So you mentioned confirmation there, Bradley. That's the last phase in the innovation decision process, and this is after adoption, right? You've decided to adopt, or indeed decided to reject, but this is when you seek reinforcement of the decision you've made, and your decision to adopt can be reversed. People do reverse their decision to adopt if you receive contradicting information after you've adopted it. And what that can result in sometimes is what they call discontinuance. So that would be the decision to reject an innovation after having previously adopted it. And a couple of ways that can happen. The obvious one is replacement discontinuance, where you just get something better. You know, so your adoption of an iPhone 5 has been discontinued because you've replaced it with an iPhone 6 Plus. Right? And then technology, that happens all the time. That's basically built into our working lives now, isn't it? Just the 3-year cycle, we're going to discontinue these fourth generation iPads and replace them with, you know, iPad Air 2 or whatever it is. But then you also get this disenchantment discontinuance, where the innovation gets rejected due to dissatisfaction with its performance. And that's a bigger problem for the innovation and a bigger risk to large-scale deployments such as iPads or any kind of computer in school. And I think one of the big reasons why this happens, Bradley, is the idea that when the innovation hasn't been what the author calls routinized into the adopter's operations. So you think about schools, right? There are schools where they're only allowed to use the iPad at certain times of the day. There's only certain number of iPads. There's only 2 in the class. So we can't have everybody on an iPad. We've got to have the iPads off to the side for a special time, and it's not there all the time. Or in secondary schools, particularly, and this is a big risk during a trial, is only certain classes have an iPad. And I've seen, this is one I've seen fall apart. Personally, I know that this has happened, where a trial has happened. And let's say there's maybe 5 classes in a year group in a school, and 2 of those 5 classes get iPads. And what happens there is that the teachers who deal with those classes, they also deal with maybe 3 other classes that don't have an iPad. And the problem for those teachers is, how do I invest all my effort in reworking all my teaching and all my stuff for this class, this one class with the iPad, when these 3 other classes have to be taught in the traditional way? And the conversation I was having today, I was advocating very strongly the idea of doing a whole school deployment in one go, because then you get a much higher chance of routinizing the use of the iPad, because everybody has it. It's a big focus in the life of the school. It's a big part of the development plan. And you go from not having it to having a huge involvement and interest in iPad. Whereas if you do it in dribs and drabs, what happens is that, you know, nobody really, it never becomes a routine thing, because it's new, and it can be years and years until everybody's got an iPad. I mean, you've probably been to schools, Bradley, as I have, where they want to do a year group at a time. And the longer that goes on, the longer you run the risk of discontinuance, because, you know, you get 6-year groups in secondary in Scotland, and it's, you're talking about a 6-year program just to get from nothing to one-to-one. And then you start having a one-to-one school 6 years in the future. Whereas if you do a whole school deployment, you have a one-to-one school much, much quicker, and you get on with the learning that is involved in having a one-to-one school.
Yeah, I mean, 6 years is a long time. I mean, you've gone through at least one refresh of the existing classes with their devices. And I think the thing is, if you're going to do some sort of program like that, you know, a lot of schools start with the older kids first. I think if you're going to do that, you almost have to start with the younger kids first and just let it cycle up.
Yeah, you got to sort of fill the pipe with that, but that becomes a horrible treadmill, doesn't it? Because every year you've got to buy new devices. Every year is a deployment year, all the time, forever, for a start. I mean, that's a reason enough not to do that. But secondly, you're on a treadmill of different devices, so you've got this kind of ever increasing upward staircase of three, possibly 4 different generations of iPad in your school at any one time. And it just cycles through and cycles through. But the hard thing, the doubly hard thing about that model, is you can never get off that treadmill, because you've always just bought a set of iPads, haven't you? Every year a new set comes in. So every year you've got a 1-year-old set of iPads. So how do I get rid of them, and how do I get rid of them? It's a very seductive path to go down, but I think it can be very difficult to live with and very difficult to get off if you do go down that way. Yeah. Okay, so last thing to observe. So those are five stages of the innovation decision process. Knowledge people, adopting your mnemonic there. Kind people don't ignore coffee. Knowledge, persuasion, decision, implementation, and confirmation. Those are the five stages that people go through, from first learning about an innovation to adopting it or rejecting it, and then trying to confirm their decision after the fact. Now, a couple of things left to say. One is, what's the role of communication channels? And there's really two phases to this, like I said earlier. Mass media is good for sharing those first three kinds of knowledge, awareness knowledge, how-to knowledge, and principles. But interpersonal communication is much more effective, relatively more important when it comes to the persuasion stage, because that's when trusted advisors and mentors and confidants come along and convince you one way or the other about the innovation. And finally, I want to mention, Bradley, the innovation decision period, which is how long it takes for an individual to pass through this whole process. And it's usually measured from first awareness to decision to adopt. And what differentiates people here is different people have different lengths of innovation decision period. It's not necessarily the case that people who are laggards just because they learned about it later, but they may learn about it at the same time. You take two people who learn about an innovation at the same time, and one person might adopt within the year, and the other person might take 5 years to adopt. And the difference can be substantial. There's one example in the book of the adoption of weed spray amongst farmers, and what they found was that the earliest adopters were taking 0.4 years from learning about it to making a decision to adopt. And the longest period that they saw on average was 4.6 years for people who learned about it at roughly the same time, but they took four and a half years, nearly 5 years, to adopt the same technology. So a substantial difference in time. And if you're the kind of person who's always taking 5 years to adopt something, you're just constantly going to be 5 years behind.
Well, you think about like the original iPod. It was announced in 2001, and like by 2005, I think it was like a mass hit.
Yeah. Yep. And it's interesting, you know, we're 5 years into iPad now, and I think that we've maybe seen a little bit of a dip. You know, we certainly have seen a dip in terms of sales, but it's interesting here, just looking at this example here, the innovators took 0.4 years, early adopters took 0.5 years, early majority 1.1 years, late majority 2.3 years, and then laggards 4.6. So for an iPad technology, maybe those numbers are different. Maybe the late majority, the early majority are taking longer to adopt. Maybe this is a technology that's not going to be adopted 100%. Who knows? But somebody who spoke to me recently, they sort of described it from another school, not from our school, described the iPad as basically the de facto computer for schools now. Or certainly one of the, but I thought it was interesting that somebody would actually come and say that, that the iPad was almost the de facto computer for schools.
Oh, yeah, it's certainly not the Mac at this point, just from a sheer cost perspective.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in Apple's lineup, no question about it, the iPad is their education computer. It's not the iPhone either. It's the iPad. And that's why I've written an article for a website about iOS 9 for education. And one of the things I said in there is that you can consider iOS 9 one of the most education-focused releases because it's one of the most iPad-focused releases. And when you do good for the iPad, you do good for education because the iPad is the education computer. So that's kind of something to bear in mind as we go through iOS 9 as well. So Bradley, let's wrap up just with a quick discussion of how are we going to apply these levels, these phases, to what we want to do in schools. And I think the key thing is information, would you say? Is that fair to say?
Yes.
We want to get the right information to the right people at the right time. And we've got to deal with their knowledge, and then we've got to persuade them, right? So knowledge is all about mass media campaigns, right? You're in a big school, it's about putting posters up, announcements, putting things in the newsletter, all that kind of stuff. But it's important to have people who go beyond how-to knowledge and get into principles knowledge. It doesn't have to be everybody, but you've got to have some people in there who are getting into the principles behind what it is we're trying to do. But then when you get to the persuasion stage, you've got to look for ways to do interpersonal communication. So buddy systems, small group learning, reaching out to people, you know, even sort of leaders in the innovation, actually just sitting down with individuals and saying, can I help you? Can I show you a few things? Can we work together? Can I maybe observe your lesson? Can I give you feedback or whatever? And also, what's also key there is modeling adoption and good practice. And one of the things I've seen when I've been to schools where they're having successful iPad programs is what's very influential is when the head teacher or a deputy head teacher or somebody in the senior management team come along to meetings and with their iPad and they use it for work. That's incredibly influential. And if you're in that situation, you're trying to persuade people, show them you doing it. And then a lot of people will follow on with that kind of example in mind.
Yeah, don't bring your laptop and then keep your iPad in the bag.
Well, it's why I always present from my iPad when I'm talking about iPad. You know, I would feel weird, you know, like standing up there and going, oh, well, iPad's great for all this stuff. And then I'm presenting from a MacBook Pro. Even though I use a MacBook Pro, I don't hold myself to only using an iPad, but I think that presenting from an iPad when you're talking about the use of iPad is the medium is the message, if you like. So that's how we could deal with knowledge, how you could deal with persuasion. How do you get a good decision? And I think really what I would say, Bradley, is that it's well-designed trials that correctly simulate the desired end condition. But leadership needs to have clarity about what that end condition actually is. Right? So is it about just getting iPads into the school for the sake of getting iPads into the school? Or are we going to go one-to-one? Is that the actual big step? Or is it really about adopting what you might call a more progressive educational philosophy that emphasizes higher order skills in a modern context? So that could be another, you know, mission statement for what ends up being an iPad deployment, but in fact is driven much more by the educational case than by the technical case. So it's critical to get the right knowledge to the right people at the right time, particularly when it comes to implementation as well. There's a massive risk of disenchantment, discontinuation, if, for example, the Wi-Fi doesn't cope or students can't install any apps. I mean, I've seen that kind of thing where schools will roll out iPads and they'll just think their Wi-Fi is going to cope with it, and it doesn't cope with it. Or schools who've launched programs, well, they've set it up in such a way that students can only install free apps, and then the teachers want to get a couple of paid apps, and there's no mechanism to do that. And that's a massive disenchantment to everybody, both teachers and students. And I think resellers have got a lot to answer for in this respect, because quite often they're very weak in their implementation, or they end up leaving schools with big flaws in their deployments that can lead to that kind of disenchantment very, very easily. And it's something to be very careful about if you're advising on an iPad deployment, not to leave these doors open. Make sure you give a full service deployment so that you can install apps and you can buy volume purchase and you can deploy them to kids and so on and so on. Have the whole set there so that you don't leave the door open for people to create disenchantment or to, you know, foment disenchantment by being not on board with the technology as well.
It's like you have a school that'll buy $50,000 worth of iPads, oh, but we're only putting on free apps. What is this?
You know, we get no money for training.
We bought an app the other day. It was like, I don't know, spent like $150 on it. Like the set, and the teacher's, oh, it's so expensive. And it's like, no, you have no idea how cheap this is for how many licenses we just got. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's so cheap compared to what we were used to with desktops licensing.
Yeah, I mean, you remember the days of paying £650 for Photoshop alone for one computer. You know, it's like, come on, you know, stuff's really, really cheap. I mean, and what you can get for free is just insane. You know, the capabilities you get for nothing nowadays is just mad. Mad in a good way, but mad still. The last thing, confirmation. What I think is really important here is to measure the right effects, okay? So whatever it is you're looking to do in your school with your iPad program, make sure you measure that. And make sure you take time to both reflect on it and celebrate that it happened, if it happened, of course. But, you know, celebrate and communicate the fact that these benefits have been achieved. You know, and we have a system of class blogs and things where we put things on the blog and parents and grandparents can look at it. And in many cases, that gives us an opportunity to showcase the things that have happened as a result of the technology, yes, but also other things that happen in school as well. And finally, if I can leave with one thing, Bradley, it would be to for people to be open to recognizing what you might call second order effects of the computer being in the school, like things that we never planned to happen, things that we don't have a metric for, but this just happened and it was awesome. So here we're going to share it and we're going to talk about what happened there as well. And those kind of things will come along from time to time. And it's worth, you know, there are schools who can get very data driven and very focused on this. And they say, well, our iPad deployment is for this, 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 and this. And we only measure this, 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 and this. And we don't use it for anything else. And there are no other effects. But there are massive effects all over the place. But you just have to, you have to have a subtle eye to see them and pick them out. And also over time to remember what it used to be like. Because we've noticed certain things in our school that, you know, suddenly turn around 3 years later and we haven't done a massive jotter order in 2 years. You know, things like that just go away and you don't notice them going away. But when you stop to think about it, that's where it comes up.
So, yeah, no, it's easy to like forget what it's like, you know, pre-technology. It's all the modern conveniences.
Yeah, and you forget that, you know, I mentioned on Twitter today that I heard about a school where if a teacher wants to show a YouTube video, they have to fill in a form with the specific URL of the video and then send that to IT to get that individual URL unblocked. So you know, I can't believe that's a thing that people are still having to do, but it definitely is. Cool. So that's our chapter five. That's the innovation decision process. Can you remember, are we just going to go straight to chapter six next, Bradley? I think that's
yes,
what we're going
to
do
chapter six for next week.
Yep, that's properties of innovations, I think it is. That's where they talk about the different things that an innovation can have or lack that will impact its ability to be adopted. And what I find when I've been reading this book and teaching it as well is that there are so many examples in technology of innovations which just obviously lacked one of these key attributes, and we'll talk about some of them, and we'll read the book and bring some examples next week. And I think it'll be interesting to think about things like Google Glass, like electric cars, like Google Docs, for example, things like that, like Apple Watch, and look at some of those. This is an exercise I'm doing with the class, having them look at certain innovations and grade them on the scale of these attributes to see, you know, was it obvious from the start that this thing wasn't going to be adopted, or is it was it a surprise? Was there some other failure apart from just the inherent attributes of the innovation that made it fail?
Well, it's a fun series. I'm enjoying the book so far. Yeah. It's kind of good. It's like out of the box thinking rather than like on the ground thinking. It's like kind of putting a retrospective in your career thus far and then looking ahead to what's coming.
It's great always, I think, Bradley, to be able to put on a sort of theoretical lens at times and look at the world through this set of glasses. And I don't think it's by no means the only set of glasses that I would ever put on to think about things, but it's an interesting way, particularly when you're engaged in activities where people want to make change, that this is one very useful set of glasses to be able to put on and look at a scene and figure out where people are in these processes and then take them to the next step.
And by glasses, we don't mean Google glasses.
No, we do not. Okay, so, shall we wrap it up there? Yep.
Yeah, sounds like a plan.
Okay, so next week we'll talk about that. Until then, I am Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web.
I'm Bradley Chambers on Twitter and on the web at chambersdaily.com.